Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals.
Good morning.
Our next case is State versus Lawrence Michael Johnson, A21-0746. I know that you both are experienced attorneys and know to introduce yourselves, that you each have 15 minutes, 5 minutes of rebuttal for appellant if you choose to use it. And noting the differences in heights between the two of you, the podium does go up and down.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are you ready to begin?
I am, Your Honor.
May.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Julie Nelson. I represent the appellant Lawrence Johnson in his direct appeal from his convictions for aiding and abetting second-degree murder and aiding and abetting felony murder. Mr. Johnson raised three issues on appeal, but I would like to spend my time today looking at the third issue, which is whether the district court abused its discretion when it denied Mr. Johnson's petition, post-conviction petition, without an evidentiary hearing.
I just want to make sure. Page came out after you submitted your brief. Do you want to just address how Page implicates your first argument?
I suspected you might ask that. Here's what I will say about Page. Page does gut some of my argument, but it does not render the entire argument moot, and here's why. Page only says that when it comes to the second prong, the reason for the delay, it says that the pandemic does not count against the state. And that's what Page says. But that doesn't mean that you could not have a speedy violation based on even when the pandemic was occurring. So it's still a matter of reviewing those Barker factors. It's a balancing test. It is not a checklist. It is a balancing test. And Mickle made that really clear. So we can still look at the fact that the entire delay was 228 days from the time that he asked for his speedy demand to the time that the trial was granted. 168 of those days would have been due to the pandemic, but 63 of those days were after there was a pandemic-approved courtroom available in St. Cloud to have this hearing.
Of course, Mr. Magnuson argues that those 63 days also were due to the pandemic, with eight judges wanting to do all of the backed up felonies and that sort of thing. How do you respond to that?
I disagree, because that would be to say that then, to me, that, okay, let me start this over. That is a backlog. And was the backlog initially due to the pandemic? Yes, it was. But the reason at that point to delay Mr. Johnson's trial was rather arbitrary. It was based on the length of the trial. We have no idea at that time whether the bench, the Stearns County bench and the district court decided that it was going to do shorter trials first. Were those other defendants that were waiting a trial, was that for a shorter period of time or not? Mr. Johnson was certainly waiting for 228 days at that point. So we don't know, and I think that that does absolutely make a difference. The reasons that they gave for doing it that way were also, they were arbitrary. They didn't make sense. It was, first of all, whether the courtroom was available. Well, the courtroom was available. Secondly, they had to make sure that they had social distancing for the potential jurors. Well, guess what? That entire courtroom was designed specifically to house and manage a pandemic-type trial. So
it doesn't seem unreasonable, though, Ms. Nelson, that in this period of time when everything is really upended, that it would be better to try something shorter in case there are significant problems and you're going to lose a jury or there are going to be other reasons why, you know, you're not going to be able to get fully through the trial. And that seemed to be the rationale. It didn't seem arbitrary to me as I read it.
And Your Honor, I understand that as well. But even in that situation, they certainly could have tried two or three or four or five cases in a week or two and then set Mr. Johnson's. Again, we don't know how long these other defendants were waiting for the trial, but we do know that Mr. Johnson was waiting 228 days. And that is a long time to be waiting trial, especially when his attorney had specifically said and wanted at the very beginning a speedy trial because she was concerned that the co-defendants might turn on her client, and that would be a very hard thing to defend against. So while I understand the district court's reasoning, the bench's reasoning for doing it, still 63 days is relatively a long period of time. Even that would be beyond the 60 days speedy trial window. And the other thing is I would like this court to at least consider its holdings in Randall and Border. Now, those are both unpublished, but in both those cases, when the defendant had argued that his rights to a speedy trial were violated because of the implementation of the COVID-19 pilot program, this court said, yeah, but as soon as trials were available, as soon as you could have a trial in your county, you had one in both those cases. That's not the case here. Here, as soon as Mr. Johnson could have a trial, he did not have a trial. It was still another 63 days later. So I do think that the length of the delay here still needs to be balanced against the other factors. So, you know, again, in answer to your question, Judge, does Page hurt? Yeah, yes, it does, I have to concede, in terms of at least the second factor, but that does not necessarily make the entire argument for speedy trial violation moot. Looking at the post-conviction decision, now we know, of course, that post-conviction hearings are used to resolve underlying factual disputes. We use them to expand the record, to look at facts that are outside of the trial record, right? The showing generally to get an evidentiary hearing is very low. Both Minnesota post-conviction statute and appellate case law favor evidentiary hearings. Any doubts about whether to grant one should be resolved in favor of having one. We're talking about, in this case, obtaining an evidentiary hearing on a claim of newly discovered evidence. And the district court in this case really muddled its analysis and seemed to say that Mr. Johnson was required to show that he deserved or he was entitled to a new trial based on the new evidence. And that's not what the standard is. When you're looking, the standard to look at is under Rayner. There's a four-factor test that Mr. Johnson was required to satisfy, and he satisfied all four of those prongs under Rayner. The first prong is that the evidence was not known to the defendant or his counsel at the time of the trial. And the evidence that we're talking about is the statement from Kishon Johnson, who 2 months after Mr. Johnson was found guilty, he came forward and he said, hey, one of the co-defendants in that case, I've got some information about it. I saw one of the co-defendants in that case the night after the stabbing.
This is a jailhouse informant,
this is the
right?
Jailhouse informant, okay. Yes, Your Honor. And there is no relation, as far as I know, between Kishon Johnson and my client, Mr. Lawrence Johnson. He came forward and he said, I was at an apartment across the street from the red carpet the night after the incident, and Stevenson, who was one of the co-defendants, was there, and he said, hey, I'm the one who stabbed Unity McGill, and he was bragging about it, and he was talking about this. This is important evidence because the state conceded that it did not know who stabbed McGill. And that is new evidence.
I think that the first two factors are satisfied. It's the third and fourth factors that I'd like you to talk about.
Okay.
When I read the record, my reading is that Kishon came forward, then he said he didn't want to be involved, and then he didn't want to be involved, said he wouldn't testify. And so how do we factor that into factors three and four?
Okay, so the fact that he said he did not want to be involved is very different than saying, I retract my statement, or I didn't make the statement, or that's not what I said. So the statement that he originally gave to Detective Peters is still his statement and all of that's in there. He has not retracted or recanted any of that. The fact that he doesn't want to be involved, well, that's another issue. But that's not for him to decide. That would be for the court to decide whether or not he needs to come in. We subpoena him. He comes in and he testifies to what he knows.
What about the fact, though, that his conviction, if I'm recalling this correctly, was for aiding and abetting. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that, you know, he necessarily was the person who did the stabbing. Why would this statement be significant with respect to that specifically?
So aiding and abetting liability of crimes for another is an interesting theory, right? You've got an accomplice, you've got a principal, and you've got an accomplice. If the jury's presented with this and they know, for example, let's say they know that who did the stabbing, that's easy. Maybe there's a video of someone actually stabbing McGill. That's easy to find him guilty. They can see him committing the crime. Aiding and abetting is different because it's not something, I guess it could be something you see, but the jury actually has to make a factual determination. They have to decide beyond a reasonable doubt that that accomplice not only knew that the principal was going to commit the crime, but that he intended his actions or presence to further the commission of that crime. And that's why this information is important, because depending on what Stevenson said to Kashan, or what Kashan overheard Stevenson say, that could be there was no plan. Johnson did not know that Stevenson had a knife. He did it on spur of the moment. And the difference there means that if the jury were to hear that evidence, they would not be able to find that he knew Kashan was going to commit a crime. I'm sorry, that he knew Stevenson was going to commit a crime and that he intended his actions or presence to further the commission of that crime. That's why that's so important. That's why this information is so important. The jury found him guilty of aiding and abetting based on the information it had. But had it been told Stevenson did this on his own, it could not have found him guilty of aiding and abetting.
So I don't see that in the statement that the jailhouse informant provided, and maybe I missed it in the record and you could help me, but you added the part about Stevenson admitting that he did it on his own. That's not the information that I understand the jailhouse informant to have provided. It was that Stevenson admitted he did it. He did the stabbing. Mm-hmm. That seems like an important distinction. You're drawing materiality from something that I don't see in that record.
You're correct, Your Honor. That is not what Kashan said, but that's why we need to have the evidentiary hearing so that we can get him under oath so we can ask him what else was said, because he clearly has material information about what happened. I mean, the fact that he has an admission from Stevenson alone that he was the stabber is important. That is not information that was ever presented at trial.
But we have the evidence that all three of them assaulted the victim.
Yes.
Together.
Yes.
It's a little confusing. I had one of the co-defendants on another appeal. But it's a little confusing. Apparently one of them was able to stay in the bar, the other two went out and came back in, or one of them snuck back in?
What happened was all three of them were in the bar. There were two fights that night. During the first altercation, Mr. McGill got involved. He was trying to help out this other person, and he hit my client who went on the floor. All three of the co-defendants in this case were thrown out of the bar. They all came back in. Unity McGill never left the bar. He stayed in the bar. And then when the three came back in, according to Kashan and what Stevenson was saying, they were all chilling. And then when McGill came by, the two Johnson brothers, jumped McGill. Stevenson came up behind him, stabbed him four or five times. The question is whether or not that was actually planned. And the fact that we know now that Stevenson's saying, I'm the one who did the stabbing, what else did he say in that apartment? That is new information. It is at least the bare minimum. It's enough to get an evidentiary hearing on this matter to determine whether or not there was a plan and whether or not Johnson knew about it. Because again, if he didn't, then the jury could not have found him guilty of aiding and abetting second-degree murder, and that's a big difference. And that's why the district court abused its discretion in denying this the post-conviction petition without an evidentiary hearing. I'm going to yield the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, it's just a minute. Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, my name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general and I represent the respondent, state of Minnesota. Appellant asked this court to reverse his convictions on three grounds. There was an alleged speedy trial violation, prejudice from various discovery violations by the state, and the denial of his post-conviction petition. I'd suggest to the court that the appellant's arguments are either contrary to controlling precedent or unsupported by the facts, and they should be disregarded. I'd like to use my time to address the arguments that appellant made in his reply brief, but before I get to that, I want to make sure I don't forget something. There was a question posed about Keyshawn Johnson and whether he had recanted or taken back his statement, and on page 4 of the district court's order denying, the post-conviction court's denying relief, that's document 244, which was filed on April 29th. On page 4, the second full paragraph down, at the December 27th, 2021 phone call between Kantorowicz and Keyshawn Johnson, Keyshawn again told Kantorowicz that he did not want to be involved and that he wanted to recant his statement. Kantorowicz claimed she told Keyshawn that he could be subpoenaed, and he said, quote, go ahead and subpoena me, close quote. On the speedy trial, I agree that Page has resolved the issue in this in the state's favor. If you apply the Barker factors to this 63 days, even if you separate it out, if you apply it, the length of the delay is the first factor. That's 63 days. It's only 3 days beyond the 60-day triggering mechanism. I'm unaware of any case that has found a speedy trial violation with only a 3 days past the 60 days.
Let me follow up just quickly on that point. I don't want to belabor it too much, but You seem to be suggesting that because the first 163 days, I think, was due to the statewide pandemic orders, that we just set that aside. I don't see that as the analysis that the Supreme Court applied in Page. So well, they definitely say that we don't weigh it against the state, that delay, but they don't just disregard the 163 days.
Well, the facts in Page were different. There wasn't this demarcation in Page, so that specific issue wasn't before the court. But I don't think it's a big factor, so I'm not going to belabor it. Okay. But counsel does focus on the reasons for the delay and talks about that the court administration was arbitrary when they moved appellant's case back. And as the district court made clear, there were a lot of factors that went into this. There's only one felony jury trial courtroom, and they're going to have their first felony jury trial. It's going to be a 3-week murder trial with a felony jury. I think that was the very definition of a considered approach as to how we're going to best move forward with this. We're going to test drive it and see how this works out. And you know, I think it's human tendency to we just want to look back at things and we see things through rose-colored glasses. And in hindsight and with the benefit of time, the passage of time, we don't see, maybe COVID wasn't all that bad. But in August, the first week in August of 2020, I went back and I looked at the COVID dashboard on the state's website. There were zero deaths. COVID-related deaths in March of 2020. By August 6th of 2020, there were over 1,600 COVID-related deaths in Minnesota. So we go zero to 1,600 in less than 6 months. I think looking back, it's hard to understate just how panicked people were. Court administrators were concerned about, are we even going to get people that are going to respond to their subpoenas? Are we going to be able, excuse me, with a felony jury trial, there's talk of having extra people who are the secondary jurors, I'm spacing on it.
Alternates.
Alternates, thank you. They're going to have extra alternates because there may be problems. And in this case, I believe there was extra alternates. So now we have to bring in even more people in there. We're going to have our first case be a complex trial that is going to take 3 weeks. And counsel alluded to the fact, well, maybe they could have tried other cases that would have been shorter. That would have been a consideration the court administration can look at. If we could have, maybe we could knock out 3 1-week cases and we could take care of 3 in-custody speedy trial demands in the time that it would take to try this one case. Maybe those cases were longer. Maybe there had been people who had been sitting in jail longer. We don't know, but to say that the court administration's decision was arbitrary when it applied this, I don't think that's a fair characterization of it. Then the third factor, we concede that, as the district court found, that the appellant properly asserted it. Then in Page, the Supreme Court looks at the three sub-factors and makes it clear that any prejudice has to be related to the reason for the delay, and in appellant's reply brief, there's no discussion of that. I'll touch briefly on the discovery violations. Again, there's, as I pointed out in my brief, if you suppress all the evidence that was allegedly provided late, we're still going to end up with the same result. The damning testimony came from the eyewitnesses. There's no evidence that that eyewitness testimony was disclosed late. The very damning evidence is, of course, the videotape, which, you know, I've watched dozens of times, and it's disturbing to watch. But it clearly shows what's going on here. And that evidence was more than enough to convict appellant here. His co-defendant, Christopher Johnson, brought a sufficiency of the evidence claim, and that was denied and rejected by this court in an unpublished decision. And I think the analysis in that case is, it's unreported, it's non-precedential, but I believe it's persuasive here. And that then ties into the post-conviction claim. And Keyshawn Johnson's, as the court has alluded to in questions to counsel, there's nothing in his statement that indicates that there was no plan, that Bryant Stevenson did this on his own. But apart from his recanting, there are other reasons to disregard what Mr. Johnson relayed. He says that Stevenson reported that, well, they were just chilling, and McGill walked by, and we jumped him. That's not what the video shows. The video shows Stevenson, I believe it is, actually goes out on the dance floor, bouncing around, and he bumps into Unity McGill. Later, he comes up back behind him. I think it's Lawrence Johnson then has his back to Unity McGill and Christopher Johnson. And Christopher is the one in the first assault. He's the one that Unity McGill punches and knocks to the ground. So he's the guy that has the real beef with McGill. So Lawrence is facing away. Christopher comes up, and as Christopher comes up, Lawrence turns away, and then Christopher attacks Unity McGill. So to refer to both of these things as fights is very charitable. These were two planned assaults where three people jumped another individual. The first one, you can see on that video, they wait until he turns his back, and then they start punching him and get him in a corner and start wailing on him until Unity McGill tries to break it up. Same thing here. Unity McGill this isn't a fight. He's never given an opportunity to throw a punch. He's immediately set upon by two guys, and then Brian Stevenson joins in, and he's up against the wall. Unity McGill never had a prayer here. This was not a fight. It wasn't something that just happened. We were just chilling. So I think the Watching the video severely undercuts the evidence that Keyshawn Johnson provides. And apart from it, it does not provide any, it doesn't exclude appellant as an accomplice here. Yes.
Counsel, what I'm not hearing you say, though, is that the statement offered by the jailhouse informant was not material. Instead, what your argument seems to suggest is that if the evidence was heard, it wouldn't be persuasive. And that, is that enough to deny an evidentiary hearing?
I don't think it's material because what would it do? What evidence, what new evidence would it provide? The complaint already alleges that Unity McGill, that appellant assisted, that either, and I think it's, I can't remember if it's a slash or an and or, but the complaint alleges that someone other than appellant stabbed Unity McGill, that either Christopher Johnson and or Brian Stevenson did the stabbing. Well, all this information does is narrow it down to Brian Stevenson. But if he alleged that another person had done the stabbing, I could say it's material. But it doesn't change what's already in the complaint and the evidence that was already presented to the jury and the arguments and the jury instructions that were made to the jury. It doesn't change any of that. It just narrows down the field of principles from Christopher Johnson or Bryant Stevenson to Bryant Stevenson, and that's not material and doesn't warrant a, didn't warrant a hearing. If there are no other questions, then I will yield my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Nelson, any rebuttal?
Yes, just briefly.
Thank you. I just have 3 points I'd like to make on rebuttal. First of all, my apologies to this court. I did not... I believe that I confused this case with another case that I have regarding a recantation. So that was not my intent to...
I speak on behalf of my colleagues. We think you're an honorable.
Oh, thank you.
If you made a mistake, it was an honest mistake.
It was an honest mistake. Thank you very much. I will still make the argument that even if he said, I want to recant it, he does not say that he never said what he said. Keyshawn still said what he said, and that that is still material, and he still needs to be questioned about it. As for the discovery violations, one of the things that I find troubling about the respondent's brief and his oral argument on the discovery violations, it seems to be that because the evidence is so overwhelming, who cares about discovery violations? This cannot be the way that trial attorneys are forced to try a case, especially public defenders, who we all know are extremely overworked. There are things that attorneys should be able to rely on when they are trying a case, a criminal case, a felony murder case. They have to be able to rely on what the prosecutors say. And when the prosecutor stands up in court and puts in writing, we have given you, defense attorneys, all the evidence that there is, and if we haven't given it to you, it doesn't exist, and then proceeds for 5 months to give additional evidence, that's egregious. And it
do you agree, though, Ms. Nelson, that they provided things when it came into their control?
No.
No.
No, absolutely not, because if you look at, when the defense attorney made a motion to compel discovery in the middle of May, that's when the statement was made, we've given you everything we've got. At least 4 things that the state, that the defense attorney had requested in the middle of May did not come out until one came out May 27th, one came out June 15th, one came out September 30th, and one came out October 2nd. Those were all things that were available at that time. Many of the things that were listed, if you look in my brief, you will see a list, A through K, of things that were disclosed after the motion to compel.
But counsel, when we get to the section of your brief that details your argument and your reason for reversal on the discovery violation. It really focuses on two pieces of evidence that were produced by the state, I think, after August. Mm-hmm. And then in that interlude, that 63-day interlude, as a matter of fact. And so, isn't that our focus? I mean, I appreciate your point. It's certainly very well taken that the prosecutor has a very important duty to turn over evidence as soon as possible. And this court backs that obligation. Having said that, to get a reversal for a discovery violation, you do have some obligations as well to convince the court. I mean, there are rare occasions where the court will just say, in the interest of justice, we're going to give a new trial. I just don't see this case as falling in that category, so maybe do you want to argue the prejudice?
Well, I would say, again, there's both, as you're, and I think Your Honor makes excellent points, but I think that there are the two types of prejudice. There's a specific, those are the two incidences, one of which was the late BCA crime scene photos. Defense attorney was very clear that she wanted to get a blood spatter analysis done and was unable to do it in the time before trial, and then asked for continuance but was denied that. Would that have made a difference? Well, it would have shown whether, when and where he was stabbed, whether or not Mr. Johnson was the one who did it. And that was really important information. But that wasn't provided until September 29th. They had that information for 10 months. And then the other information was the possible alternative perpetrator based on the statement by Jessica Rampersad. Now, I know that the state says, no, there wasn't an alternative perpetrator, da-da-da-da-da. Well, forgive the defense for not wanting to just believe what the prosecutor says about evidence. The defense needs to do that on their own. And when these disclosures are made at such a late date, it is very difficult to do the due diligence to determine whether or not what needs to be done, how it's to be done. And that's the problem with the specific incidences of prejudice. And then again, just as I already talked about, I'm sorry, I'm out of time. Can I take 1 minute to finish?
Finish.
Thank you. The general overall prejudice, because this was discovery that was trickling on for another 5 months. And just one more point on the credibility of Keshawn Johnson. That is not for the post-conviction court to decide prior to an evidentiary hearing. It certainly is not for this court to decide whether or not he's credible. That's why we have evidentiary hearings. Mr. Johnson requests that this court either reverse his convictions or at the very least remand for a post-conviction evidentiary hearing. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. The case was well argued and briefed, and we'll have our decision out within the 90 days.